Welcome to the Student Press Law Center podcast, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit source of information and advocacy for the student media, and we work to break down the barriers that prevent college and high school journalists from doing their best work. For more information about the center, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lamonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. Well, the obituary has been written over and over and over again for America's professional newspapers. While it's true that the circulation and readership of print news products is in decline, there is still a healthy following of people who like to read and produce print publications, America's high school students. Anecdotally, those who work with student journalists have long perceived that journalism is one of the most universally popular scholastic activities. But until recently, that perception has been anecdotal. That is, until the Center for Scholastic Journalism at Ohio's Kent State University undertook a comprehensive census of high school journalism programs across the country and came up with some eye-opening results. We're going to talk about the state of high school publishing today with the lead author of the 2011 Scholastic Journalism Census and what those census results say about the health of student journalism and the areas most needing attention. Well, it is a special treat and pleasure to welcome this particular guest to the SPLC podcast because Mark Goodman was the leader of the Student Press Law Center for longer than anyone else in the organization's history. Mark served as executive director of the SPLC for 22 years, and he is now the Knight Chair in Scholastic Journalism at Kent State University's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mark is a graduate of the Duke University School of Law and of the University of Missouri School of Journalism. Mark collaborated on the 2011 census with Candace Perkins Bowen of Kent State and with Peter Bobkowski of the University of Kansas. And Mark Goodman, welcome back to the Student Press Law Center podcast, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Frank.
Let's start out. Explain to us a little bit the motivation behind undertaking this study and the methods that you and your team used.
Sure. Well, you know, the reason we did this is because of a realization that we spend a lot of time talking about the prevalence of high school scholastic media, but nobody really seemed to have very accurate numbers. And actually, this was prompted in part by a conversation I had with Eric Newton of the Knight Foundation, who asked my sense of whether the numbers of student newspapers specifically was increasing, decreasing, or staying the same. And I said to him at the time, honestly, Eric, I said, I don't think anyone has an accurate picture of that. And so it sort of was prompted by the realization that in order to assess high school journalism and where it's going, we have to know where it stands. And our methodology for doing this was what we hope would be the most thorough and complete survey of this kind. I mean, others have attempted to do this over the years with smaller samples or more directed sort of research, but we use the National Center for Education Statistics database of public secondary schools around the country, a little over 18,000 schools, and we picked a random sample of about 4,000 schools from that sample, and then did a survey of those schools, specifically directing the survey to the school principal with the hope that and the clear indication that even if a school had no student media at all, we wanted the survey returned for them to tell us that. And we got about a 23% response rate, which the survey experts tell me is pretty good for this kind of survey, and we believe it actually presents a pretty complete picture.
Yeah. Well, give us an overview of the findings of the census and what in particular was noteworthy and perhaps surprising to you.
Right. Well, you know, honestly, we've really just scratched the surface. I mean, in our initial report on this, we came up with six sort of key findings. But honestly, we have enough research to keep us busy for at least another year or two in reporting what we found. But among the things I think that were most noteworthy is how prevalent scholastic journalism was in American high schools, that, you know, 96% of the public high schools in our sample, in our survey, had some student media experience available for students. And in fact, 71% had two or more different student media outlets. That number was higher than I expected. Among the other, you know, research that we, or the outcomes that we uncovered were that yearbooks were by far the most common type of scholastic journalism in a school. Roughly 94% of schools had a student yearbook. A very low percentage of schools actually had student media with an online presence. And that is something I think that's alarming. I'm sure we're going to talk more about. We also noted that indicators of the presence of scholastic journalism were school size. The bigger the school, the more likely they were to have a scholastic media experience. Also, poor schools and schools with larger minority populations were less likely to have any student media at all as well.
Yeah. Let's focus in on that last one. I want to talk about this idea of a gap between economic haves and have-nots when it comes to journalism opportunities, as your census seems to have disclosed. What consequences does that gap in opportunities have, not just for the well-being of the schools, but also down-the-road consequences for those students?
Right. Well, you know, and one thing that our research didn't tell us is anything about the makeup of the individual staffs of those publications. I mean, it could be the case that at other schools that do have student media, there is a, you know, healthy minority student representation on the staff of those publications. Anecdotally, I think many of us would say we're not confident that's the case across the country. But what I think our research does tell us is that, you know, at a school that has no student media, it's much more likely to have a larger minority population. And as a result, those students who perhaps have the greatest need to have their voice heard because of how underrepresented their voices are in their school and community have the least likelihood of making that happen. And I think you're right, there's an impact of this far beyond high school. These students are also not going to be exposed to the role media can play in providing accurate information and serving as an information source to the community when their communities may need that as much as any other community.
Right. It strikes me, too, that we hear many, many times that professional newsrooms do not reflect the racial and ethnic makeup of their communities, and that minorities are historically underrepresented in professional newsrooms. And perhaps we have a root cause here, right, that if students are not getting this bug because they're not getting the exposure and the opportunity when they're 15 and 16, maybe that will never ignite.
Exactly. And I know, you know, the commercial news media organizations are concerned, as they have been for 30 years or more, about the lack of minority representation in commercial newsrooms, specifically in newspaper newsrooms. This reflects one reason for that. I mean, the pipeline simply doesn't exist in the way it should, and I think it suggests that one valuable use of their resources would be to, again, continue focusing on trying to bolster the role of scholastic journalism and the opportunities for minority students in it.
Sure. Well, what does it tell us that in the year 2011, where just about every student is involved in some kind of online publishing in his or her personal off-campus life, we still have relatively few student journalistic publications online?
Well, it tells us that something's not happening that should be. And again, our research doesn't really give the causes for this. But when the fact is that only 33% of the schools have any online student media, that is troubling, I think. And you know, as I've said to others, that it both reflects the lack of preparation for the world of journalism that we're giving students. I mean, the idea that you can operate in a world that has no online connection in journalism today, I think is just laughable. But it also reflects that we're not teaching students the values and the ability to be effective online media consumers, which is one of the most important roles that Scholastic classic journalism plays in high school. For those students who aren't going to go on to be journalists, they're all going to be media consumers, and we need to teach them how to consume media and what forms it comes in and how it's different based on the format in which it appears. But in any event, to me it's a reflection of a problem, and I have speculation. Our research really didn't indicate what the problem is, but I have to say I don't think it is primarily as a result of students and teachers. I think there are other forces at work here that probably play a bigger role.
Right. Well, let's expand on that a little bit, because I think we all encounter this, and many educators encounter this when they try to take their publications online, that there are various institutional obstacles that are placed in their way, whether it is from administrators, whether it is from the IT department in a school. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, again, beyond the scope of the census, but just from your own exposure to people who are teaching and perhaps trying to take publications online, what are some of the obstacles that they're encountering?
Yeah, well, any of us who've worked with Scholastic Journalism for any length of time, I think, will tell you that one of the biggest roadblocks to student media moving online are school officials and their fear that somehow exposure to the larger audience that an online presence results in is going to cause headaches or problems for the school. And in fact, you know, as we all know, the SPLC knows this better than anyone. There are a significant number of schools out there that have specifically forbade advisors and students from creating an online component for their publication. And again, I think very short-sightedly, very naively, but that's what they've done. The other problem, I think, is for many schools, they even if they don't object to the idea of a publication having an online presence, they are not willing to give the advisor and the students the resources to be able to make that happen, if only just in the time it takes. I mean, you know, as one advisor said to me, you know, producing a print newspaper every month is a full-time job around my other teaching responsibilities. To also produce an online version of that publication takes additional equipment, additional software, additional resources, and support that the school just hasn't really been willing to provide. So, I'm a big believer that if schools cared enough about this, they could change that number. Students and advisors may not always be eager to press the boundaries, but I think they're much more interested and willing to do that than school officials are.
Sure. And going back to the earlier point about economically challenged schools, it would seem, right, like online publishing might be a partial solution in that
right.
Online publishing can be done almost cost-free, correct?
Exactly. I mean, you know, in terms of the process of, you know, distribution, it's much simpler, and the printing costs go away entirely. One thing I do hear, though, from students and advisors repeatedly is that they don't want to see the end of the print edition. Students still place a value on a print publication, and I certainly would be a big advocate for the print product continuing, because if for no other reason than I do think it exposes students to a print newspaper in high school that we really want them to be familiar with when they go out into the outside world. But I think it's a separate question as to whether or not the print product alone is a sufficient experience in scholastic journalism. The answer to that, I think, pretty clearly in this day and age is no.
Sure, sure. And I suppose to your point about not only will students use those skills that they gain to be better consumers of news, but there are all sorts of gainful positions out there in the economy for people who know how to build, use, and maintain websites, even if they are not doing it in what you and I would think of as a traditional newsroom context.
That's an excellent point, yeah. I mean, if only from a vocational training perspective, it seems like the school should really emphasize the creation of online content. But again, what it comes back to me, I think the single biggest factor is the fear school officials have of exposure of student work to a broader audience. despite the fact that many student newspapers and other student publications may be distributed in very small ways into the community, this creates basically a worldwide audience for it. And I think schools are extremely concerned. Part of that concern may be about liability. They're afraid someone will sue them over what gets published, although I think that's pretty baseless, but I think that may be in the back of the minds of some school officials. But I think the bigger concern is things that we have talked about internally in the pages of our student publication now will be there for all to see, and we're not sure we like that idea.
Sure, yeah, this idea that suddenly when the principal is up for a superintendent's job in another district, that when his name is Googled, that the story about how his disciplinary processes were criticized as unfair is going to come up high in his Google results.
Exactly. I mean, it's a classic motivation for government censorship. I mean, you know, and it's as illegitimate as any could be, but that's what I think is behind a lot of this.
Sure. Well, just wrapping up the discussion about the census, tell us about your plans for first of all, how do you envision that this data might be used by people, whether yourself or other researchers or policymakers, and that are there plans to continue updating into the future?
Well, let me answer the second question first. We definitely do plan to do this again, and we don't have the exact time frame yet, but my guess would be probably in 2 to 3 years. We will decide the time is right to do another incarnation of this. And of course, what's going to be most interesting with that, I think, is to see how these numbers have changed. I mean, if the number of student media have decreased, or the number of online student publications have not increased, that's going to tell us, again, that there are some serious problems here that need to be confronted and dealt with. But, you know, beyond that, in terms of just the data we have and the data that we will be continuing to publish over the course of the next year or so, what we hope that this will do is help scholastic journalism organizations, colleges and universities, and others better figure out how to serve the scholastic journalism community. One of the things, for example, that we discovered is what a large percentage of scholastic media experiences in high school are tied to a class. That 88% of the public high schools in the survey sample we had offered a journalism or publications class. That's a huge number, and I think one thing that it suggests is we all need to be providing more support, resources, help to those classroom teachers, many of whom come into this without any training in journalism, so they can do their job better. I mean, this is a really key component to quality scholastic media, is supporting the classroom teachers. So that's one thing. The other thing, as I already alluded to, the presence of yearbooks. I think too many people today still think of yearbooks as not being journalism, when in fact they are, and as we all know, the best yearbooks in the country are as, you know, excellent examples of journalism as you could imagine. And I think what we need to do is probably help more yearbooks think of themselves as journalistic enterprises and include more training in issues like, you know, media law and press freedom and ethics and responsibility in those yearbook classes in places where that hasn't already become an important part of it.
Those are excellent, excellent points, and I hope everyone will take some time to review and to think about the findings of this census. And we certainly thank you and Kent State for finally getting a snapshot on what so many of us had been talking about in anecdotal terms for so many years. So,
Frank, you know, one other thing I'd like to say is to all those people out there who are thinking about, you know, year-end charitable giving, there's no more worthy organization than the Student Press Law Center, and we all know what good work it does. Every dollar given to the SPLC helps a student journalist or an advisor in need, and we're certainly big believers in that at the Center for Scholastic Journalism, and I hope the listeners to your podcast are too.
Let's thank you to Mark Goodman for a lifetime of service to the scholastic journalism community, of which this census is just the latest example. You can read the entire 2011 Scholastic Journalism Census on the beautifully redesigned website of the Center for Scholastic Journalism, that is CSJKent.com. csjkent.org, csjkent.org. We also hope you'll take advantage of the legal and educational reference materials available to you on the SPLC website, splc.org, that you'll join the Student Press Law Center's group on Facebook and follow SPLC on Twitter. And if you're a student journalist or a journalism educator with any question about the law, call our hotline at 703-807-1904 or email us at splc@splc.org. Thank you for listening.